It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Kirk O'Bear will be back with us next week. Well, the first topic this morning I want to talk about is drunk driving. And there was a big story. There's one of the individuals running for Attorney General, Brad Schimmel, who's the Waukesha County District Attorney, has come out saying that he actually was convicted of first offense drunk driving in 1990 when he was in his 20s. Had a drunk driving ticket, and of course it was a first offense, drunk driving, non-criminal. And so now that generated a debate as to whether first offense drunk driving in Wisconsin should be a crime or not. As you may know, in Wisconsin, unlike 49 other states, we're the only state where first offense drunk driving is not a crime. Now, I think that is actually deceiving because there are people who believe that we are not that we're too lenient on drunk driving. Well, that's not the case at all. In fact, if anything, I believe that we are very strict when it comes to drunk driving. And there are many reasons for that. First and foremost, the prosecution is required in all cases to seek convictions in drunk driving cases. Now, that doesn't mean that every drunk driving case that's charged ends up as a drunk driving. It doesn't mean that cases don't get dismissed or amended to something other than drunk driving. But it means the legislature has put in this requirement that they seek convictions. Whereas if you go to other states around the country, including Illinois to our south, they have different laws on this. And in Illinois, for first offense cases, now I don't practice in Illinois, but my understanding of the practice down there is that if you have a first offense drunk driving in Illinois, yes, it's technically criminal, but it almost never stays that way because they actually have a program to reduce charges, which basically involves court-ordered supervision for a while, and then the OWI is reduced or dismissed or whatever the case may be. We don't have the same thing in Wisconsin, although, as I said, cases do get amended or dismissed, but it's just a different process. You have to show certain things. The bottom line is, in Wisconsin, it's in the upper 90s in terms of the percentage of people who end up entering pleas to some kind of drunk driving offense and get convictions. And that's for a variety of factors. Many people in a first offense case don't hire a lawyer. Or they may just want to, as many people say, get it over with. They don't want to fight it for whatever reason. Or even if they do, the prosecution fights the cases hard when it comes to drunk driving. So in Wisconsin, unlike in other states, we don't have a lot of these programs like other states do to reduce or amend drunk driving. So when it comes to other states, you're really comparing apples and oranges. It's not the same thing. And so the question came up with Brad Schimmel, the Waukesha DA, county DA, who's running for attorney general, as to, well, he has this first offense drunk driving conviction from years and years ago. I think it just goes to show that many people in positions of power, people are not immune from getting a drunk driving citation or ticket or charge. We see this all the time in our practice, which is you get people who come in. This is the first time they've ever had a brush with the law, and they're just, you know, they're very concerned about it. And these are, by and large, I would say the overwhelming majority, wonderful people, very good people coming from good backgrounds. You know, they may have made a mistake or whatever the case may be, but that's the main thing. So I think we make a big mistake if we're judging people's character simply based on the fact that they've gotten in trouble before for drunk driving. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm merely saying that we ought to be careful when we criticize because it could happen to any one of us. I mean, this could happen to a lot of different people unless you absolutely just, you know, never get in trouble for anything. But, you know, there are a lot of people who have these types of things. And so the research that I've seen shows that if we were to criminalize first offense drunk driving, first of all, I've already talked about how the reasons why I don't believe we're lenient on drunk driving in Wisconsin. But secondly, when it comes to actually making first offense drunk driving a crime, you have to think about a lot of things in this. And this is what Brad Schimmel brought up. You know, he talked about how it's extremely expensive if we were to make first offense drunk driving a crime. Now, I don't know what the exact statistics on it, but I do know that there was a proposal to make third offense drunk driving a felony charge, and that would cost the state annually approximately $200 million. Now, when you talk about making first offense drunk driving a crime, there are many first offense drunk driving citations issued in Wisconsin every single year. And if you criminalized all of those and made potential jail time on all of those, that's going to add to your jail costs. You're going to need to hire more prosecutors. You're going to need to hire more defense attorneys. You're going to need to have more judges. And there's a whole lot that goes into that. But the real thing that I think most people are worried about is, will this actually make a difference? You know, will it reduce the rate of drunk driving? Will it reduce recidivism, if you will? And the statistics that I've seen, the research that I've seen, shows that really increasing the penalties for drunk driving does not reduce recidivism. In other words, it doesn't have an impact as to whether somebody goes out and does something like that, or whether somebody gets in trouble for drunk driving in the first place. There was, to be fair, a study that showed that a very, very short sentence of 2 days may result in reduced recidivism, but that was somewhat of an anomaly. The rest of them said, essentially, that the length of the jail is not reduced to whether somebody doesn't do this again. The biggest deterrent when it comes to drunk driving is, in fact, the rehabilitation aspect of it. And what I mean by that is treatment, things like that, allowing somebody to demonstrate their sobriety, rather than just throwing them in jail and expecting them to get better. Now, you might say, well, they ought to be punished because they did something. I don't necessarily care if they get better. Well, then let's just be honest about that. If the goal is not to improve or decrease, if you will, the rate of drunk driving, and the goal rather is just to punish people, and you don't care exactly what the results are, well, then let's be honest about that. But in terms of what I'm thinking, I think the best possible thing to do would be to reduce the rate of drunk driving. And I think most people agree with that. So there was actually a study done out of the state of Washington. I believe this was in 1980, where the state of Washington passed a law mandating jail time on all OWI first and OWI second offense cases. And they basically tried to determine whether this would actually reduce the rate of drunk driving. What they found was there was actually a higher subsequent crash and OWI offense rate under the new law that mandated jail time on a first offense case and second offense, rather than the old law that didn't. And I think there are many reasons for that, but the main reason is the focus was solely on increasing the jail time. And if you don't have some type of rehabilitative aspect of that, how are you ever going to expect to solve the problem? And I would argue we've seen this with lots of different crimes over the years, that simply, although a punitive nature, most people believe, should be a part of at least some offenses, depending upon what that offense is, that's really not the solution. As long as this isn't some type of offense where we're talking about locking somebody up for life, they're going to get out at some point. And if they're going to get out at some point, society has an interest in making sure that that particular person does not repeat. So, there's a lot of people criticizing Brad Schimmel. And, you know, Brad Schimmel is, you know, he's a prosecutor. He's on the opposite side that I am. If you think about it that way, I'm a defense attorney and he's a prosecutor. And, you know, I agree with Brad Schimmel on this. I think that he's correct and he's bringing a lot of things to light. But first and foremost, what he's saying is, show me the research. If we're really going to do this, if we're really going to criminalize all first offense drunk driving in the state of Wisconsin, then show me the research as to why that will actually reduce drunk driving. And if you can't show me the research on that, well, isn't that a bit of a problem? And on top of that, we have probably hundreds of millions of dollars in added expenses, hiring of more prosecutors and public defenders and, you know, all kinds of people, court staff. And is that actually going to do something? You know, some of the articles I was reading, there were lots of prosecutors' offices who were saying, hey, you know, we're overworked as it is, and we can't afford to have, you know, in most counties, hundreds of additional cases come in every year that we have to deal with, or I shouldn't say in most, but in some counties, hundreds of additional cases, because that's what you're going to get when it comes to criminalizing first offense drunk driving. In many states where drunk driving is a crime for the first offense, either they have a diversion program where the person ultimately doesn't get convicted of first offense drunk driving, which we don't have that type of program in Wisconsin, or they don't end up going to jail, or some mix of those two. So there's a lot that's different. And by the way, not all first offense drunk driving is non-criminal in the state of Wisconsin anyway. In certain situations, such as causing an injury or having a minor in the vehicle, it can be a criminal offense. So you've got lots to think about, I think, on this one. And I don't think it's so black and white. And I think a lot of the critics of Brad Schimmel are really not pointing to any evidence of how this is going to work, other than saying, well, we need to criminalize it because 49 other states do. But it's not comparing apples and oranges, as I said before. And it's not looking at the underlying goal as to what you really want to accomplish with this. What is the goal exactly? This is Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. We'll be back in just a moment.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. And there's a bill that's generating a lot of controversy in the state of Wisconsin right now, or at least some controversy, I should say. But it's an interesting one. And it relates to drug use and drug users and their liability. But basically, this from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, users of heroin and other drugs would be immune from liability if they called 911 to report overdoses, and more first responders could carry drugs to counteract those overdoses under two bills a legislative committee considered on Thursday. Members of the Assembly Criminal Justice Committee heard emotional testimony from the parents of those who died of drug overdoses, as well as others. Alex Hoffman of Menominee Falls, whose son died of a heroin overdose in July, said, "I've seen things that nobody should ever see. I watched my son shoot up heroin before I stopped him. I watched him try to withdraw from heroin on his own. I watched him battle schizophrenia, which is brought on by heroin, induced by it. I watched my family disintegrate as we tried to save him, and I watched him die." Another measure that they're considering is it would make it easier for communities to set up drug disposal programs. So there's a whole lot of proposals here on the table. And as I said, one of the measures would make people immune from criminal prosecution for drug possession if they brought someone to an emergency room, or they called 911 because they believed the person was suffering from an overdose. They would also be immune from prosecution if they administered Narcan, which counteracts overdoses from heroin and other opiates. So they actually interviewed a doctor with the Wisconsin Medical Society who praised the bill. But he actually said it should be extended to more circumstances, such as people under 21 should not be charged for possessing alcohol if they call 911 when their friends are too drunk or have had too much alcohol, I should say. You know, and that's something that I think is a good idea, because we do see the tragedy of this happen in many different communities around the state, where young people get addicted to certain substances, and heroin tends to be a big one at this point in Wisconsin and really around the country, but there are other drugs out there. And it's just a tragic story, because you see so many people, so many good people, so many good kids, by the way, who get addicted. They might start on some kind of pain pill, and then after that, they go to heroin after they've run out of their pain pills and their doctor won't prescribe any more pain pills. Well, then they go to harder drugs. You know, so it's just, it's one of those things that is tragic from all angles. And when you look at this, I think, apart from the obvious emotional draw of these bills, I do think that they make, for the most part, a lot of sense. You know, when we're talking about possibly prosecuting somebody criminally for drug possession when they're the person who brought their friend to the emergency room or called 911 because they believe the person was suffering from an overdose. Yeah, under a strict standard, you might say, well, that person should be prosecuted too because they were the ones that were also possessing this drug, and we ought to prosecute them. Well, you know what? There's a greater good to this, and if those folks are helping out their friend who is about to die from an overdose, and they call 911 or do the responsible thing by bringing their friend to the emergency room, I really don't think society has a whole lot of interest in prosecuting the friend for trying to save their other friend's life. And yes, even if that friend happened to be using some type of drug on that evening. You know, I mean, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do it that way. Because you want to, the law is supposed to encourage good behavior. And if the law is discouraging, I would argue it would be discouraging good behavior by saying, you know what, if somebody actually overdoses or is, you know, has taken too many drugs for whatever reason, would you rather have that person stay home where they're not being cared for by trained medical personnel, or would you rather have that friend take him to the hospital? Because there might be a deterrent, and that person well may not take their friend to the hospital if they think they're going to get in criminal trouble themselves. So I think we want to encourage this type of helping people when they're in these situations. It's not to say that using heroin is a good thing. It isn't. And nobody's arguing it's a good thing. But what people are saying is that if there is a situation, and there are many of these situations where somebody's trying to help out a friend and they themselves have been using drugs, you know, we really shouldn't be prosecuting those people for doing that. So, and then this other bill that would allow any first responders to administer Narcan if they were trained, which is given to either intravenously or as an inhalant, but it counteracts the effects of opiates such as heroin. And Narcan, in many cases, is the only thing that to actually save somebody, somebody's life in these situations where, for example, they've overdosed on heroin. And I think it's good that people are talking about these things because we see it. I mean, we see it every day. We see it all around our country and our community where people are suffering immensely because they have an addiction to a certain substance. And it probably used to be the view in large part that, okay, these people are doing a bad thing and it's their fault and they're the ones that are taking the drugs. And of course, they have to accept personal responsibility for taking the drugs that they do. But if we don't look at the underlying issues, if we don't treat the underlying issues, and if we don't have legislative policy in place that encourages people to get help so that they don't fear actually being arrested for trying to get help for some type of addiction that they have, that's a good thing. We need to encourage that in our society rather than discourage it, because really that's the only thing that's going to help somebody. As we've talked about many times, although there are lots of offenses that may deserve some type of punitive nature to them, such as jail time, that doesn't mean that what you do is you totally take out any aspect of rehabilitation for people who are suffering from these things. I can't tell you the amount of wonderful stories that I've seen of people who have gone into treatment and better their lives and turn their lives around and come out to be wonderful people. Now, it doesn't work with everybody, and there's certainly a fairly significant rate of, you know, falling off the wagon, if you will, when people go into certain types of treatment. They have to want to be there. That's for sure. But that being said, just because there is a rate of failure associated with treatment doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, and it doesn't mean that society shouldn't look at improving ways that we can tackle this problem, because we know it's a problem. We know it needs to be helped. And the other thing with the Narcan that could save people's lives when they're doing drugs such as heroin. And again, this third bill that would allow communities to set up drug disposal programs. and it would also give the State Department of Justice the ability to authorize drug disposal programs, including those that collect syringes or other drug delivery services. And these might seem like controversial things to some people. But let's face it, as long as society isn't perfect, and as long as these drugs are out there, which they are, and as long as people are using them and people are getting addicted to them, you know, it's important to find creative ways to deal with the problem, and simply increasing the maximum penalties and simply talking about how we need a stricter war on drugs and we need to lock these people up for longer periods of time, we know that hasn't worked. And we know it's not going to continue to work. So why do we keep beating our heads against the wall with something that's not going to work? I mean, they've tried that in the federal system and many state systems around the country. They've tried making mandatory minimums for all kinds of offenses. And I'm talking particularly about the federal system. And you know what it's produced? Hasn't produced a decrease in the amount of crimes. It's produced a lot of judges who say, and rightfully, I think, you know what? We really don't like these mandatory minimums all that much because we're not able to judge somebody's situation on a case-by-case basis and do what judges are supposed to do, which is look at a case, look at it objectively, and determine what the appropriate sentence or outcome ought to be in that case. That's what judges are elected or appointed to do. And we've taken a lot of that discretion away, but you know, I have to say, there's a lot of hope here, I think, because now we have legislators who I think during certain periods in our history wouldn't think of proposing a bill, bills like this. I think they're beginning to recognize that this can happen to anybody's son or daughter. And in fact, there was a legislator who... a Marinette Republican whose daughter has struggled with heroin addiction, and this is Representative John Nygren's daughter, he introduced some of these proposals. And so, you know, I give kudos to him because he realizes, regardless if he could take a, you know, a tough on crime stance and say that this is, we need to lock more people up, you know, he understands what's going on because he's had something like this happen close to him. And he recognizes what's going to be good for society versus not good for society and not solve the problem. So we'll follow these stories as they develop further on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm Casey Hoff, and we'll be back in just a moment with more Legal Defense.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Kirk O'Bear will be back with us next week. Well, there was a Milwaukee County transit worker who got into some hot water. In fact, I believe he was terminated from his employment because he intervened in a domestic dispute. This from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, when Milwaukee County bus supervisor William Bierman Jr. saw an apparently intoxicated man battering a young woman on a city street, he decided to act. Bierman broke up the pair, but only after being slugged twice by the man, who was cited by Milwaukee police. And this article asks whether he's just another good Samaritan or not. Well, less than 2 weeks after the incident, the Milwaukee County Transit System fired him. They said, quote, "You acted outside the scope of your employment as a route supervisor, compromised your own safety, and exposed your employer to potential liability and its image and reputation to potential harm." Now, he's thinking of suing them, but the point of the story is things have changed. They've released the actual video. Now, he was waiting for a replacement bus to arrive, Bierman was, because he was supervising buses on the south side of Milwaukee when one broke down. And as he was waiting, he heard a young woman who was screaming for help across the street. And so Bierman, when he saw this woman, He also saw a man named Ruben Alcantar grabbing the young woman by her hair, wrenching her arm, and calling her a stream of curse words, according to the Journal Sentinel. Bierman said that he yelled at the man to let the woman go, but he refused, shouting a profanity in response. And so Bierman said he then tried to call police dispatch, but the radio in his company car wouldn't work. He doesn't have a cell phone. Cell phone was in his lunchbox because bus supervisors aren't allowed to carry or use cell phones while on the job. So because he was unable to reach the police, he got out of his car to help the woman. And the man then charged at Bierman, according to this story, pushing the bus route supervisor twice and punching him in the chest a couple of times. Now, Bierman's apparently bigger than the other man, and so he grabbed the man by his hands to keep him from grabbing any possible weapon. But the man then pulled away and ran up the street. Bierman would later say, quote, "I didn't want to detain him. I'm not a cop." So this story says the version of events that Bierman gave the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is generally consistent with what he wrote in his transit report and what he told police. According to the police report, the young woman said that the man is her boyfriend and that she started the disturbance. The report said that she spotted the man at a bar with another woman, so she poured beer on the pair, prompting her boyfriend to chase her down the street. So the question is, should he have been fired? And we hadn't yet seen the video until this week, really. It was released publicly. And it seems to me that in this situation, this man, Bierman, was trying to do the right thing. I mean, he was trying to break up a possible domestic disturbance. And if his story is true, and I have no reason to doubt it, that, you know, he tried to call police on the radio but wasn't able to, and he didn't have a cell phone on him, so he couldn't do that, and he saw this woman in trouble physically, then what is he supposed to do? Is he supposed to just sit there and wait? Is he supposed to not help this woman? I think that's a pretty bleak view of humanity. To me, he was trying to be a good Samaritan and do the right thing. And for that, he was terminated from his job. So, you know, it actually took a lot of courage to do what he did because he didn't know what could have happened. I mean, this guy, for all he knew, could have had a weapon. He could have had a gun. He could have had a knife. Something like that. His friends could have been around the corner. I mean, you never know. So whenever somebody intervenes in a situation like this, it's always dangerous. And a lot of times people will say, officials will say, don't do that, don't ever intervene. Well, you know what? In this situation, he was trying to help a woman. And he saw her and you know, he didn't know what else to do. You know, if you believe him, and I certainly don't have any reason to doubt what he's saying, especially when we see the video. So he was fired, and after this story came out, there was a whole lot of backlash against the bus company or the Milwaukee County Transit System that fired him. And rightfully so, I think. Is it true that potentially the bus company could have liability? I don't know. I'm sure it's possible, and I don't do that type of legal work. I do criminal and traffic defense, but I'm sure it's possible, and they're probably right that there could be some kind of liability. But the bottom line is, you got to look at all of these situations in their own right. It's not like, at least according to his story, it's not like he went out and just, you know, caused this confrontation or disturbance. He said that he viewed a disturbance and confrontation between this man and this woman, and he didn't have any other option because he tried to call police. He didn't have a cell phone. So he was honored this week by certain city officials and by a Milwaukee alderman. and by the Milwaukee County Executive, Chris Abley, and the Milwaukee County Sheriff. So he was honored for doing this thing, and his quote was, "I'm not going to watch someone be a victim, and I speak for many people that I'm not the only one who would have responded in the manner that I did." That was his quote, and now Chris Abley, the Milwaukee County Executive, is saying he watched the surveillance video, and he said, "Just looking at the video, it's hard to see the grounds for a termination, and so we've asked them to reconsider it, and we'll see what happens." So I'd love to follow this story, and we will. But there were some other interesting things that Mr. Bierman said. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Milwaukee County transit worker who was fired after he intervened in an altercation between a man and a woman. He intervened trying to break it up because he saw this woman and believed she was in trouble. And he was fired less than 2 weeks later by the company. So Bierman said in a recent interview, "I guess I'm supposed to act like nothing was happening. Don't be a human. Don't be a citizen." And, you know, there's a lot of truth to what he said. And certainly I'm not encouraging people to go out and be vigilantes or anything like that. That's not it's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm arguing. But I am saying that there are certain situations in society, and we recognize under the law things like self-defense and defense of others, where somebody needs help, and you know many places have good Samaritan laws and things like that. And if they need help, that society recognizes that they can do that, and maybe they should do that. Because if we just have a whole bunch of people sitting around not helping each other out, what kind of a society do we live in? And again, it's not to say that nobody should go out and commit a crime. Obviously, that's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that there are lots of situations where this type of thing might unfold. What would have happened if the man had had a weapon and had pulled it out? And what would have happened if, let's say, for example, he shot her? Would the bus company still have fired this man for intervening in that situation? I don't know. I don't know what would have happened, but it's a tricky balance, because when you think about these things, you think about, well, you know, we have to judge each situation on its own merit, and we don't want everybody intervening into everyone else's problems, but he apparently believed this woman was in physical danger and could have been hurt very badly. And so he intervened for that. And he even said, he didn't want to detain this man because he said, "I'm not a police officer." And so he didn't do that. So he was clearly, seems to me, was thinking about this whole situation in terms of whether he should do that. And he obviously had reservations about it, because if he didn't have reservations, he would have just run out there right away. But he says, you know, he tried calling over the radio, but it was so bad that it didn't work. So what do we do with situations like that? Well, a lot of them will come up, and they're interesting for discussion. And, of course, we'll talk about them more. I want to remind you, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm Casey Hoff. You can listen live by going to WHPL.com. You can also listen to our podcast at WHPL.com as well. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm Casey Hoff, and we'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Talk about a weird, crazy story. This from Beaver Dam. An Illinois man will pay a $250 fine, and this is from Channel3000.com, for using a stun gun on his wife after making a bet with his wife on the Packers-Bears Monday night football game back in November. Not the recent one where the Packers won, but the other one. John Grant, 42, of Tinley Park, Illinois, pled no contest Thursday in Dodge County Court to one count of possession of an electric weapon in connection to the incident. Grant and his wife were at a bar watching the Green Bay Packers play the Chicago Bears on Monday Night Football in Mayville back in November. The couple made a bet that if the Packers lost, Grant would get to use his stun gun on his wife. You can't have a stun gun to begin with. That was unlawful, but this is how it went. Grant's wife told Mayville police that her husband hit her with a stun gun twice, and someone else used the stun gun on her a third time. She said she was not injured and did not want medical attention. The woman told police she did not give anyone permission to use the stun gun on her, but Grant told police that there was a cell phone video and text messages of his wife talking about the bet. Officials said the video and text messages showed the woman consented to the bet and being hit with a stun gun. She told police she did send the text messages, but didn't think her husband would actually use the stun gun on her. He ended up doing so. So police determined that Grant's wife did give consent to being hit with a stun gun, but Grant was arrested on charges of possessing an electric weapon. So boy, is that a weird story. You make a bet over the Packers-Bears game, and it involves a stun gun and getting to use it on each other. Doesn't sound like my idea of a fun relationship. But Scott Walker was picked for jury duty. Yes, Governor Scott Walker. He was picked for jury duty this past week, but he was ultimately dismissed. Here's how it went. The circuit judge in Milwaukee County, or one of them, advised Walker and a dozen other jurors late this past Monday to arrive promptly at 8:30 a.m. Tuesday for the start of what was expected to be a two-day trial. The governor was going to be hearing a personal injury lawsuit. And so Governor Walker was not picked for a murder trial on Monday morning, and that's probably why he was sent to this personal injury trial, because they had multiple trials down in Milwaukee County. Walker said that he'd been called twice for jury duty in the past, once during his tenure as Milwaukee County executive, once while serving as an assembly representative. After he was stricken from the murder trial, he said that it was not too much of a surprise to him that he was passed over in the morning. So he didn't hear this murder trial, but he was going to sit on this two-day personal injury trial, and he did end up sitting on it. However, he actually he disclosed to the judge, which was the right thing to do, through law enforcement officials, that he had received $2,000 in campaign donations from the CEO of one of these insurance companies, and the insurance company was the defendant in the case that Walker was hearing in Milwaukee County. So he told the law enforcement official, who told the judge, and it was then determined that Governor Walker would not serve on the jury, but rather, well, he would be an alternate juror. And he was dismissed from the case after closing arguments. So he heard the case and was dismissed after closing arguments. He said, told the Associated Press, that he hopes that his experience shows that anyone can be selected for jury duty and that, quote, nobody should consider themselves too busy to be picked, end quote. But he did say that he enjoyed his experience of sitting on a jury. And I should say this, because lots of people, when they're on juries, have different experiences, but I think the overwhelming majority of people who serve on juries, at least as it relates to criminal cases, are glad that they've done so. And I'm sure civil cases as well, but I really don't know much more about the criminal realm on that end. So I think they enjoy it because they feel like they're giving back to society. They're doing their duty as citizens of the United States. They're helping out with the justice system, and they should think that way because they do that, and they're doing a job that is vitally important for our society. It's necessary to have jurors sitting on juries because it's something that that we wouldn't have our justice system without it. Juries have their critics, but by and large, I think juries are a very good thing. And so this is something where it's important that we can show that anybody can be picked to serve on a jury. Well, we talked last week about the Colorado law that has legalized recreational marijuana use, at least in small doses. And that law generated a lot of controversy because some people were predicting sort of doomsday scenarios, while others were saying, that this is actually a good thing because it's going to be taxed, and then the state of Colorado is going to get the revenue. And it turns out that a lot of the marijuana shops are running out of pot, and others are raising their prices because apparently the demand is so high, pardon the pun, and I don't mean any by it. Oh, and look who just walked in. It is Kirk O'Bear.
Howdy do!
And
Casey, what are you doing?
Kirk,
did you record the radio show without me?
I'm doing the show
without you. What's the big idea?
Yes. Well, it's just one of those things. But Kirk happened to pop in. I've been saying that you'd be back next week, but you happen to make a surprise guest appearance on the show.
That's right.
And one of the things that that you've been doing, you've gotten a little bit of media attention this week for something that you're doing with the Sheboygan Armory. And although this doesn't relate to criminal defense necessarily, it doesn't relate to that.
Right. Pretty much not at all.
It's important for Sheboygan. So why don't you go ahead and tell us?
It is. And I just, I know that you know a little bit about this. And if you've listened to the radio, you've heard Mike Kinzel report on this. You've also heard an interview that broadcast earlier this week on B93. So we've talked to the Sheboygan Common Council. There was an article in the paper, both on Thursday and on Friday, about this whole thing. But just in case you don't know, there is a quandary that the Common Council is facing right now in Sheboygan about what to do with the armory. As you've probably heard, the Sheboygan Spaceport has vacated or is vacating the premises by the end of January, and they've moved to a new facility over on the other side of the river. Now, the question becomes, what will the city do with this property? Just a little bit of history behind this. Casey, I know that you're a big historian and a history buff.
I love history.
Much like me.
Yes.
And this was a building that was built in 1942. It was a project that fell hot on the heels of after they completed the Sheboygan County Courthouse. And it was a Works Progress Administration site. And for those of you that don't know what that means, is that that was part of an economic stimulus idea where we had people come in, craftsmen from around the state, around the county, and use their skills to construct public facilities. And this was one that was built, as I said, in 1942. It's been the home to many, many public events in our city and is really part of the history of our city. Some people were surprised to hear that, for example, the Johnny Carson Show broadcast live from the Armory.
I didn't know that.
Yes, absolutely. The very first summer training camp that ever occurred for the Harlem Globetrotters was held there at the Sheboygan Armory.
Wow.
When they were a brand new team, they decided to hold their summer training camp there in our city of Sheboygan. It's also been the home of the great North-South rivalry basketball tournaments, and it's also the home of the oldest professional basketball team in the United States. It was called the Sheboygan Redskins, and it was called the NBL at the time, the National Basketball League. Now, aside from the history, we've created a group called the Sheboygan Armory Foundation. And the idea behind it is that we're gathering community resources, community leaders, and trying to have a dialogue with the city to encourage them to explore what we think is the most reasonable opportunity here to preserve this structure and use it for city revenue. We know that everybody's got economic concerns about everything, and that has to be the primary concern in terms of what to do with a piece of property like this. On the one hand, it's prime real estate. It's right on the lakefront. It's directly across from the Sheboygan Yacht Club. It's right near the beach. So certainly for any kind of development there would be noteworthy and probably very valuable for the city. The problem is, however, this is a structure that is so well built and rock solid that the cost involved for tearing this thing down would be absolutely tremendous. I mean, the concrete walls are many, many feet thick.
Right. I mean, it looks like it'd be a good place for a bomb shelter.
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, it is a bomb shelter.
It is a bomb shelter.
Yes. Okay, and if we were going to, if the air raid sirens went off and you live in that area, that would be where you would go, awaiting for the ICBMs to fall out of the sky.
So you don't want this place to be turned into an Olive Garden?
Well, or a casino or some sort of another water park or whatever the case may be.
Is that what they're thinking about?
They're talking about possibly just putting it up for sale, waiting to see if some billionaire comes along and snatches it up. Well, first of all, we think it's a bad idea. And secondly, one of the things that's being floated around is just destroying the place and trying to redevelop that property. Our foundation has been created. It's a nonprofit organization. The idea is that we would like to partner with the city and have a win-win scenario where the city is not going to have to worry about the economic downside of this whole thing by utilizing not only volunteer efforts but fundraising activity, seeking benefactors, and we already have a great number of people that are part of this movement. We've been talking to architects, historians, really kind of a team of lawyers out there that are working on getting the place listed on the National Historic Registry, and a number of other things that we think will advance this proposition that, hey, we're just trying to turn the armory back into what it used to be.
Well, it sounds like a good idea to me, and of course, you know, you're doing good work. That's Kirk O'Bear, again, making a guest appearance. You'll be back to fight with me next week.
A guest appearance on my own show, right?
A guest appearance on your own show. Okay, not exactly a guest appearance. A cameo?
I don't know. That's good.
All right.
Sort of like Alfred Hitchcock in his own
yes.
movies.
On Kirk's own show. And, of course, we will be back with Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey next week when I'm sure Kirk will give me a hard time.
Absolutely.
Have a great weekend.